20. Sunday was the final day of the optometrists' convention at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco, California. By 10 o'clock that night, many of the optometrists were beginning to say goodbye and trickle out of town by car, bus, train, however they had arrived at the start of the week. Their hall in the hotel was littered with paper and cigarette butts, and along the wall were empty bottles. Here and there, small groups of optometrists shook hands and exchanged addresses. The inner circle that had gathered around Hugh Collins met for their secret and expensive last fling of entertainment at Ed Guffey's hotel room in a less publicized and less strict hotel in the Negro slum business section near Fillmore and Eddy Streets. In all, there were 11 men in the inner circle, and every one of them was damp with eagerness. Hugh Collins cornered Tony Vakui, who was already in Guffey's hotel room when the group arrived.
Well, where is she?
Vakui said,
She's coming, keep your pants on.
All week, he had been nosing near Thisbe, but this night, this concluding interlude promised to be the one. Louise, to his relief and delight, had obligingly remained in Los Angeles. Everything was set. He could scarcely contain himself.
All set,
Guffey said, smoking on his cigar.
She's supposed to be coming, Collins said, rubbing his upper lip with the back of his hand.
This beat anything. The gewgaws from Mexico that he had distributed among the boys, the art films he and Guffey had got from the amusement park people, his own scrapbooks of models and sun-worshipping nudists.
Is it gonna be worth all the loot? Guffey demanded. It sure is, he said. You bet your bottom dollar.
He began to pace restlessly, wishing she would show up. The optometrists were murmuring, exchanging wisecracks and jokes, punching one another. Some of them had their gewgaws with them and were putting the plastic figures through their paces, but the boys were tiring, seeking the genuine article. One of them cupped his hands and catcalled at Collins.
What you say, fella? About ready?
About,
he said, perspiring. Another yelled,
Where is this pig?
Hey, hey,
they chanted.
Bring on the greased pig!
Keep it down,
Guffey warned. The optometrists, squatted in a circle on the floor of the hotel room, chanted in unison,
Bring it on! Bring it on!
One of them got up and began to shimmy in his nylon shirt and pinstripe trousers. His tie flopped foolishly as he placed his hands behind his head and wiggled his fleshy hips. And then they were silent. The optometrists ceased their horseplay. The joke stopped. Nobody moved. Thisbe Holt, in her transparent plastic bubble, rolled into the room. An audible gasp went up from the optometrists. Vakui, in the hall, had booted her in through the open door. He now shut the door and locked it. The bubble came to a stop in the middle of the room. Thisbe filled the bubble completely. Her knees were drawn up, hugged to her stomach. Her arms were wrapped around them, clutching them tight. Her head was bent forward. Below her chin and above her knees, her bloated breasts jutted up and were flattened at the inner surface of the bubble. The bubble rolled a little more. Thisbe was now face down, her buttocks visible, the two bare divided hemispheres. A distortion of the plastic made them seem to spread out against the bubble's surface. Again, the audible gasp went up. One of the optometrists pushed the bubble with his shoe. It rolled, and the forward side of Thisbe returned. Her nipples, enlarged by the transparent surface, were blood-red splotches. Smeared and caught. She was smiling. Oh, God in heaven, Hugh Collins thought, and his avidity made him shiver. All of them, all in the circle, were twitching and grimacing. A St. Vitus dance moved through the room.
Look at those tits, an optometrist said. Wow.
Get the size of them.
Turner,
an optometrist said.
So her ass is up.
The bubble was shoved. It revolved, and again the underside of Thisbe was visible.
Look at that flesh,
a voice said.
Can you get the bottom up? One of the optometrists said. You know, from down under, so we can look up.
Several of them delicately tapped the bubble, It rolled too far, and again they were staring at Thisby's knees and breasts.
"Try again," Guffy said, down on his hands and knees.
They tried again. This time, they were able to get the bubble just right.
"Wow-wee,"
an optometrist breathed. "Look at that." It was unbelievable. They nudged the bubble from one side of the ring to the other. Thisby, magnified and distorted, rolled toward them and away from them. As the bubble turned, her leering face, breasts, knees, feet, buttocks came and went, a procession of steaming, pale yellow flesh. The waxy surface rotated, and the inside of the bubble became translucent with her perspiration. Now, her mouth was pressed to the breathing holes of the bubble's surface. She was taking in deep gasps of air.
"Say," an optometrist said, "can we get her around in that difference so the hole is, you know, at a different place?"
But when they tried to turn the bubble, Thisby turned with it. Hugh Collins, sitting on the floor, stuck out his foot as the bubble rolled toward him. He had taken off his shoes. Most of the optometrists had. And now he booted the bubble with his bare foot. The bubble was warm, heated up by the woman inside. It was like kicking her bare flesh. He giggled. On the far side, Ed Guffey kicked the bubble back.
"Over here!"
an optometrist yelled, his feet up and ready. The bubble started in his direction.
"Mine!"
another yelled, sticking his hand in the path. The bubble rolled over it, and he squawked. Faster and faster rolled the bubble. Thisby, her mouth to the holes, wheezed and struggled for air. The mists, rising from her flesh, rose up and obscured her. A glimpse, now and then, they saw the blood-red nipples, the spheres of her behind, the soles of her feet pressed to the inner surface.
"Oh, boy!"
an optometrist shouted, lying full length on the floor.
"Roll it over me! Go ahead!"
The orgy mounted. It came to an end abruptly when one of the optometrists conceived the idea of pouring a Dixie cup of water through Thisby's breathing holes.
"Okay," Tony Vakui said, stepping forward to take charge. "That's enough. It's over."
Spluttering, flushed, Thisby climbed from the bubble.
"Goddamn beasts," she said, standing up and flexing her legs.
Tony threw her a robe, which she buttoned around her.
"Is that all?"
Guffy demanded, chewing angrily on his cigar.
"For $200,
another optometrist said, "we ought to at least get to Gooser." Tony herded the girl out of the room, keeping the optometrists off with his shoulders. The door to the hall slammed. He and Thisby were gone.
"What a robbery,"
Guffy said. In the center of the room, the empty bubble remained. Hugh Collins scrambled out into the hall and after Thisby and Vakui.
"Wait a minute,"
he panted, catching up with them.
"What is it?"
Tony said unsympathetically. Thisby, beside him, was muttering an uninterrupted flow of abuse.
"You had your fun. You got what you paid for."
"Wait," Collins said. "I mean, let me talk to her alone for a second."
"What do you want to say?" Vakui said. "You can say it in front of me. Come on, we don't have all night. I gotta rub her down."
"I had the impression," Collins said, glancing at her prayerfully. "You know, the motel room. This is the last night."
"Get him,"
Thisby grated, and she and Vakui disappeared out onto the street. Collins, humiliated, slunk back to Guffy's room. When he entered, the optometrists were in an uproar. Some wanted to go out on the streets looking for fun. Others wanted to give up and go home. One was on the phone calling for a cab. He had a cab company which he claimed would transport them en masse to a halfway decent house of prostitution. Guffy was examining the empty bubble.
"Look at the size of this thing," he said to Collins. "You could get a couple hundred pounds of stuff into this."
"Like what?"
Collins said, uninterested.
"Anything. Say, I think I got an idea for some fun."
He drew Collins over to the bubble.
"Look, you can seal it up. Maybe it'll leak a little, but not much."
He fitted the section back into place, closing the slot through which Thisby had entered and left. The optometrists gathered to see what was up.
"Like the old water bomb,"
Guffy said, making a pow motion with his fist in his palm.
"Smack! Right off the roof! And then we get the hell out of there!"
"By God,"
Collins said, struggling to salvage something from the collapse of his schemes.
Right. One big grand slam. Something they'll all sit up and notice. Hell, we'll be out of here in a couple of hours or tomorrow at the latest. What do you say? For old time's sake?
They experienced the sentimental tug. They were bound together in this parting hour of their comradely union. Not for another year. Not until 1957. Who knew the changes in a year? Ah, the bonds of the old pals.
Go out with a bang, Guffy said. Right? So they'll know us. That was back in 56 when the boys dropped the bubble from the roof. Remember that night in 1956? That's tonight, boys. We're having that great old night right now.
This was optometrist history. This was a milestone in convention roguery.
How are you going to fill it? Collins demanded. Where are we going to get 200 pounds of crap this time of night?
Guffy laughed.
Let's get started. It's a cinch. That's the trouble with you guys. No imagination.
They collected ashtrays, a couple of small table lamps, toilet paper from the bathroom, a pair of old shoes, beer cans and bottles, and dropped them into the bubble. It was only a beginning.
Here's what we do, Guffy said. You fellas get outside and pick up stuff, whatever'll fit in. Tin cans, anything you see. Get back here in 20 minutes,
he said his watch.
Right?
In 20 minutes, the optometrists straggled in, some with nothing, some more soused than when they had left, a few with armloads. At a supermarket, still open, they had bought dozens of eggs, aging vegetables, quarts of milk. At a drugstore, they had picked up tin waste baskets, a set of cheap dishes, some empty cardboard cartons. One optometrist had picked up a trash dispenser from a street corner. Another had lugged back in his car a garbage pail from the doorway of a locked-up restaurant. They dumped everything into the bubble. Space remained.
Water, Guffy said. From the bathroom.
They rolled the bubble to the bathroom and managed to get it near enough to a faucet to fill the remaining space with water. Gushing and dribbling, the bubble rolled about the bathroom. Water spurted from Thisby's breathing holes.
Hurry,
Guffy ordered. The optometrists, perspiring and grunting, rolled the bubble from the room to the stairs. There they hoisted it up and lugged it, step by step, to the top floor of the hotel. The door to the roof was unlocked, and they rolled the bubble out onto the asphalt surface and to the edge. Below them was the street, the cars and neon signs and pedestrians. His hands slippery with water and egg and milk, Guffy said,
"Here we go, boys!"
They lifted the ponderous, rubbish-filled bubble over the railing and let it go.
Scatter!
Guffy shouted, and the optometrists, without waiting for the results, ran back down the stairs. In a moment, they were scrambling from the back door of the hotel to the parking lot and their cars. Ludwig Grimmelmann, within his third-floor loft, felt the stir of the night and knew that he could not evade the elements around him. He could not escape reality. In his heart, he knew that they got everyone sooner or later, and they would get him. They would have him, and there was nothing he could do to save himself. He put his eye to the slot and saw out onto the dark evening street. He saw the shapes and shadows, the objects in motion. He saw the figure across the street, and he knew that Mr. Brown of the FBI had him. Mr. Brown was there, in the obscurity, waiting. Mr. Brown had caught him, and he was going to destroy him. There was no mercy for the Ludwig Grimmelmanns. He thought to himself that his mistake had been to believe that by putting it off a short while, by delaying and protracting, he had got away with something. But he had got away with nothing, because now they had him even more completely than ever. They would not settle for anything less than the disposition of Grimmelmann and his hopes and fears. And he was not prepared to give that. He had withheld himself, and he would not now give up. He would not surrender merely because his situation was hopeless. The people who had met him and watched him thought that he was a kind of nut. But he was not a nut, and Mr. Brown knew that. Mr. Brown had looked for him and found him, and he had spent a great deal of time in this job. There was not that much time to waste on nuts. But, he thought, Mr. Brown was not going to tell anyone, and that was part of the situation. He put on his black wool overcoat and his paratrooper's boots, and then he activated the emergency alarm hidden under the corner of his work desk. An Army Signal Corps transmitter, bought from a surplus supply store, put out a coded message in response to his act. Joe Mantilla, in his room at the back of his family's house, received the message and knew that the time had arrived. Now nothing remained but the escape itself. He had already destroyed the vital papers, documents, maps, and clippings. Leaving the loft light on, so as not to tip off Mr. Brown, he opened a side window and tossed out a descent cable. A moment later, he was going down hand over hand. His feet touched the ground, and he released the cable. It was drawn back up into the loft by a spring. The night was dark, and he felt the invisible motion. He was aware of the comings and goings, the messages alive in the air. Climbing a fence, he dropped into a yard. He went up a driveway, hunched over and running, looking back to see if Mr. Brown had followed. Nobody had seen him. He sneaked over fences. He ran by houses, across lawns, in and out of yards, creeping and hurrying and climbing and gradually making his way across town toward the flat industrial section. Pausing for breath, he looked back. He studied the darkness behind him. Then he went on, his black coat billowing and his boots slapping the pavement. A car rolled by, its headlights blinding him, and he hid behind a parked truck. Was it them? Had they seen him? He ran on, down a driveway and over a fence. When he reached the corrugated iron shack, the motor of the Horch was already on. Noise and fumes filled the shack as he slid the door open. Joe Mantilla stepped out and said,
"All ready."
"You have the transmission disconnected from the relay?" Grimmelman said, snorting.
"It's all finished. Ferdy's out in the Plymouth. Who goes with you in the Horch?"
Grimmelman said, "Take to Plymouth and go on back." He got into the Horch behind the wheel. "This is a negative situation. If I manage to break through the police apparatus, I'll contact you. Otherwise, assume that the organization has ceased to exist."
Joe Mantilla stared at him.
"Did you think we had a chance?" Grimmelman said.
"Sure,"
Mantilla said, nodding. Shifting into gear, he drove the Horch from the shed and out onto the street. Joe Mantilla raced past him and across to the Plymouth. The Horch turned right, and he was going in the direction of the freeway leading out of San Francisco. Wind rushed at him as he drove. From his coat pocket, he took out his goggles and fitted them over his eyes. On Van Ness Avenue, he made a right turn. Two blocks later, a San Francisco police car fell in behind him. Grimmelman saw the police car, and he realized that he was not going to get away. But he had realized that already. He put his foot down on the gas, and the Horch moved ahead. He got down in the seat as low as possible and gave the engine more and more gas. The police car continued to follow. The siren, softly at first, began to wail. The red light behind him blinked on. He saw it blinking, blinking. The light peered at him. Along Van Ness, the other cars pulled to a stop, and he was the only object in motion. He drove faster. How cold the night air was. He tugged his coat around him and held onto the wheel with one hand. Wind whipped at him, and for a moment, he could not see. He put his hand up to straighten his goggles. Ahead of him, a second police car appeared from a side street, and Grimmelman drove across the double line to avoid hitting it. The police car disappeared behind him, and he drove back into his own lane. In that instant, the Horch sideswiped a car that had halted for the siren. A fender tore away, and Grimmelman spun the wheel. Again, the Horch veered to the left. A shape, its headlights white and immense, grew directly in the path of the Horch. Grimmelman threw up his hands, and the massive Horch crashed into the lights. Behind him, the police sirens whined to silence. The two police cars appeared to his right. Grimmelman clambered from the wrecked Horch. His coat was torn, and a gash across his neck dripped blood. He ran a few steps and stumbled on the curb. Then he was up on the sidewalk, and one of the police cars had started after him. Still he ran. He did not slow down or stop. The signs along Van Ness Avenue were off, and he hid in the darkness of a used car lot. Before him was a tower, and he crept past it. He slid behind a car as two policemen hurried by with flashlights. As soon as they were gone, he crawled to the front of the car. From his coat, he took a jumble of wires and keys. He fiddled with the lock of the car door. The door opened, and he crept inside the car. Closing the door after him, he lay on the seat with his head down beneath the dashboard. He He opened a knife and sawed through the insulation of the ignition cable. Down the street at Herman's garage, Nat Emanuel and Herman were working together, pulling the head off a 1947 Dodge that belonged to Nat's auto sales.
"Hey," Nat said, "what's the racket?"
He walked to the entrance of the garage, peering to see. At first, he saw only the two police cars, and then he saw one of them move on farther along the street. He saw the wrecked cars, the horch, and the car it had struck.
"Jesus,"
he said.
"What's going on?"
Herman said, coming out beside him. Peering, Nat saw the two policemen hurrying along the sidewalk with flashlights. The policemen passed Looney Luke's lot, and Nat, still watching, saw the shape creep from behind the tower to the row of cars, and then into one of the cars. He saw the door open and shut. He saw Grimmelman inside Looney Luke's car, fiddling with the ignition.
"He's stealing one of Luke's cars," Nat said.
"Yeah?"
Herman said.
"Where?"
"See?" Nat said. "He's in the car. Look at him. He's trying to jump the ignition cable."
"He sure is,"
Herman said. Nat said, "I'm going to call the cops."
"Why?"
Herman said.
"He's stealing one of Luke's cars."
Herman said, "Don't call the cops."
"Why not?"
Nat ran back toward the phone.
"So he steals one of Luke's cars," Herman said. "You damn fool. Luke's the biggest thief in San Francisco. Every car in that lot he stole in the first place, you know that."
"It's against the law," Nat said. He disappeared into the garage, and Herman heard him dialing excitedly.
"What's one car," Herman said, "to Luke?"
He watched the figure within the car trying to get the engine started. What kind of a man, he wondered, was Nat Emanuel? What a strange idea he had of what was right. How little Nat had learned.
"Let him steal it," he said,
but he was talking to himself. Parked off Van Ness Avenue in the Plymouth, Joe Mantilla and Ferdy Heinke witnessed the wrecking of the Horch and the capture of Grimmelman by the police.
"It's gone,"
Ferdy said. They drove with their headlights off, away from Van Ness Avenue. When they were safely on a side street, they switched on the lights and speeded up.
"He sure didn't have a chance," Joe Mantilla said. "He never even got that car off the lot."
For a half hour, they parked at Dodo's, trying to decide what to do. If they stopped by the loft, they ran a risk. Neither of them said it, but the organization had ceased to exist. Now they hoped only to stay out of the hands of the police.
"We better tell Art,"
Ferdy Heinke said.
"The hell with it,"
Joe Mantilla said.
"I'm going home. We better not be seen together for a while."
"Suppose he goes over to the loft?"
"He stopped going there,"
Joe Mantilla said.
"He's gone back home."
But he backed the Plymouth onto Fillmore and made a left-hand turn.
"I'll keep the motor going while you run and tell him."
In front of the house, Ferdy leaped from the car and ran up the walk to the basement steps. The lights in the living room were on, and he knocked on the door. Art opened the door.
"What's going on?"
he said, surprised to see Ferdy Heinke.
"They got Grimmelman,"
Ferdy said.
"Don't go near the loft."
"How about the Horch?"
"They got that too. Better lie low for a while."
He started back toward the Plymouth.
"There's nothing we can do."
Art waited until the Plymouth shot off, and then he went back inside the apartment. At the kitchen table, Rachel was writing a letter.
"What was it?"
she asked, putting down her pen.
"Nothing,"
he said.
"Did they get Grimmelman? I knew they would."
She continued writing.
"It's too bad, but you knew it was going to happen. I think it's a good thing as far as we're concerned, but I'm sorry for him."
He seated himself across from her and leaned back until his chair was resting against the wall.
"That's the finish," he said, "of the organization."
"Good,"
she said.
"Why?"
"Because it was a mistake. What was Grimmelman trying to do? Fight them the way they fight? So naturally they won. If you fight them that way, they have to win. They have all the power. The thing we have to do is keep quiet and not let them notice us."
"It's too late," he said. "I'm already down on the draft list."
Rachel said,
"But maybe they'll get tired and give up. They may decide it isn't worth it." If every time you're called, we go down there and argue with them and keep stringing it out...
Sometimes I feel like giving up, Art said, and just saying, what the hell? Go ahead and draft me.
If they draft you, we won't make it.
Will we anyhow? He said.
If we want to.
I sure want to, he said vigorously.
Rachel said,
did she buy you the clothes you were wearing when you came back? I never saw them before, and you didn't have any money.
She bought them for me, he said.
Even the suit?
She put down her pen.
Did she pick them out?
Yes,
he said.
It's a nice suit. I was looking at it. I guess she really liked you, and she wanted you to look nice.
She beckoned him toward her.
See if there's anything you want me to change.
Going over, he found that she was writing to Patricia. In the letter, she was wishing them luck in their marriage and saying that she hoped the four of them could get together someday soon. He read the letter, and it seemed okay to him. Below his wife's signature, he signed his own name. Rachel folded the letter and put it in an envelope.
How do you feel?
She asked. Since his return, both of them had been under the weather. They were still hesitant in each other's presence.
Better, he said.
How would you feel, Rachel said, if I worked full-time for a while, so we'd have more money?
I don't think you have to.
It might be a good idea. Then there wouldn't be any chance that we'd have to ask somebody for help.
She picked up her coat and put it over her shoulders.
You want to come with me?
I'll mail it, he said, taking the letter.
Do you want to see them again?
Sure, he said. I don't care.
But we have to be careful, Rachel said. Anything from outside could hurt us. Isn't that so? Anything that might come in and get between us again? There's so much danger that something that isn't real might come along. And they'd convinced us it was important, you know? Something they made up, a bunch of words. They never stop. There's always something they're saying.
Her face showed worry, a tight little face, lined with concern. He kissed her, and then he walked to the door.
I'll be right back, he said.
Anything you want?
Maybe you could pick up something, she said. Maybe a Dodo's. Some ice cream.
Following him, she said,
you know what I'd like. One of those pizzas.
Okay, he said. I'll bring one back.
He walked up the steps to the path, and then, his hands in the back pockets of his jeans, he turned in the direction of Dodo's. Against the pavement, his heels scuffed and clacked. In the cold evening wind, his black leather jacket flapped back, lifted up, and held. At the corner, he mailed the letter. Then he went on toward Dodo's. The drive-in was several blocks away, and he walked slowly, gazing at the bars, the closed-up shops, studying the cars that passed. He nodded to a couple of friends. At a corner, four guys he knew were lounging at the side of a drugstore, and he stopped to say a few words to them. Going on, he crossed the street and continued past a closed-up clothing store. Ahead of him was a group of people, and now that he looked, he noticed a parked police car. A police ambulance drew up to the curb, and he realized that something had happened. The group of people had collected at the entrance of the old Pleasanton Hotel. Bits of debris were littered across the sidewalk, eggshells, pools of liquid, lettuce leaves and stalks of vegetables and trash and broken dishes and crumpled paper. The ambulance attendants were carrying the stretcher onto the sidewalk, and the group of people were being moved back by a San Francisco cop.
What happened?
He said to a couple of kids standing at the edge of the group.
Some joker dropped a load of crap off the roof,
the taller of the kids said.
Yeah,
he said. They all watched, hands in their back pockets.
Every damn kind of thing.
The kid bent down and picked up a fragment of glass.
Some sort of plastic.
Anybody get hurt? Art asked.
This lady, she was walking along. It must have landed on her. I don't know. I just heard the noise.
Art pushed up closer until he could see. The junk was heaped up on the sidewalk, and the remains of some globe-shaped transparent shell rested in the center of the debris and rubbish. A policeman was taking down information from an elderly gentleman with a cane. Stepping from the pavement, Art walked on past the ambulance and away from the group. As he reached the corner, a police car slid in front of him, and a light was flashed in his eyes.
"Let's see your ID, kid," a cop said.
While he was searching through his wallet, two cops stepped from the car and up to him.
"How come you're out after 11 o'clock? Don't you know there's a curfew?"
"I was mailing a letter," he said.
"Where's the letter?"
"I mailed it."
He was still fumbling in his wallet. He started to reach inside his jacket to see if his packet of ID cards was there. Suddenly, one of the cops grabbed his hand. The other cop shoved him back against the wall.
"What do you know about that stuff off the roof?" the first cop said.
"What stuff?"
"Off the hotel roof. Were you up there?"
"No,"
he said, and his voice was thin, weak.
"I was just coming by."
He pointed back in the direction he had come.
"I was out mailing this letter."
"There's a mailbox back there."
"I know," he said. "I mailed it."
Another cop appeared with three more kids. Each of the kids was trembling and scared.
"These were back at the hotel."
He gave them a shove, and they stumbled forward.
"They must have run out the back," a cop said.
"Take them down,"
another cop said, already starting off. At the curb, the radio in the police car bellowed out calls and numbers.
"They're out after the curfew. Book them on that until we get some kind of story from them."
He was yanked away from the wall and shoved with the other kids into the police car. As the car pulled away and into traffic, he saw that the police were picking up more kids. More police cars were entering the block, and he thought to himself, "If I hadn't come out to mail the letter."
"Honest,"
one of the kids was saying.
"We don't know nothing about it. We were just walking along."
He was a Negro.
"We were just going up to the drive-in, you know?"
None of the cops answered. Art, looking through the window, held on to his wallet and identification cards. The cops had not examined them. They had loaded him into the police car in too much of a hurry. He wondered if they would still want to see the cards. He wondered if they were going to ask him his name, or if they really cared.